André Ruda. He's a lecturer in Paris at the Epistemology and History of Philosophy department. And his background is, I think, originally in mathematics, no? And then you shifted to philosophy, wrote your PhD on Euclid.
Right.
And now you are working on a category theory and its philosophical implications for analytical philosophy, metaphysics, etc. And I think we have about 2 hours scheduled for your lecture. You can handle it as you like with questions afterwards or during.
Yeah, please feel free, just interrupt me at every point. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to speak here. So I'll try to say a few words about category and topos theory. It's a huge subject, of course, and maybe about some philosophical ideas behind it. And here is my plan. It's maybe a bit too much, but I'll try to be actually brief on every point. So I'll start just talking about we call structural mathematics of 20th century, and I would like to distinguish 2 points. First, it involves kind of new way of building theories, what I call structural theories, and particularly what's called categoristic problem. Actually, it has nothing to do with category theories. Again, terminology coincidence. And then I would distinguish, say, structural way to build objects. To build theory is one thing, and to build object, what does mean to be mathematical structure, more or less. So that I'll try to show you with some details, and then I stress the point which actually led to development of category theory, its importance of maps, not only structures, right, by maps between structure. That's all mathematical topics which can be drawn back at least to Gauss' works in geometry. But that was actually crucial in developing category theory. Then that's the second part, a bit more philosophical. Say I would talk a little bit what I call embodiment or mathematical concept. Actually, it's all problem. Say one of central problems of Kant's critique of pure reason, among other important texts about relationships, say, between mathematical concepts and mathematical objects, and the role of intuition. I would not speak specifically about intuition, and here I just again try to follow, say, classical case, which is more or less treated by Kant, and then this new way of treating this problem in 20th century. And finally, what I'm trying to suggest is idea that category theory, we again somehow have some change in that respect. So there is some new ways of say building mathematical objects, and then I more specifically will talk about category theory. So I at least will give you a formal definition and some examples, and those examples would use this structural mathematics as a background, and that's how it's historically came about, right? But then I'll show how one may think, and people really do think about categories without structure. So my, how to say, line is this category theoretical thinking, in certain respect, it derives from the structural thinking, right, from structuralism. But in my understanding, at least, it goes beyond this, at least, classical structuralism. Yeah, then I just introduce some basic notions of category theory. Then I'll talk maybe after a short break in second hour about topos theory a little bit. Here I would be more rely on hand waving, because to really do that mathematically we would need, you know, more background that I can provide during an hour. And here it's very important, and I think not yet completely understood, but really fascinating thing about topos is that it has, you know, the last biggest, at least most complete source on topos theory is what Peter Johnston in Cambridge. He published 2 volumes, and the 3rd volume should come about hopefully soon. It's called The Sketches of the Elephant, you know, referring to this Indian tale that there are blind people touching elephants and comparing their say, impressions, which are very different. And the fascinating thing that it's, you can look at that from, say, logical point of view, geometrical point of view. And actually, historical geometrical point of view was most was original, say, earlier. But logical point of view is easier. So at least to give a good definition of topos, I rather would give a logical point of view, because it simplified things a lot, which was also very important, I think, in development. And finally, that is more or less work in progress, and not only of myself, but other people who are working on that, what could be something like, because here we would have, say, examples of something like categorical objects, right? I show how we can build objects with category theory, how to do series with category theory, right? That's something really, I think, very interesting topic, but it's really research. So here again, I not give you complete, result, because they are not there about, but rather some direction of thought in which some other people work, in which I'm trying to work myself. Yeah, here it's going to be the only quote for the whole thing, and that's beginning of Hilbert's Foundation of Geometry. That first edition was published in 1899, and I think it just to show what that today we might call structural theories. And actually, nowadays, this so-called structuralism, at least in philosophy and science, has become recently, actually, rather surprising, kind of fashionable, in UK particularly. But actually, when I look historically, it's already was all there, at least in the beginning of the 20th century, not only in mathematics, but also in philosophical reflection, for example, in text by Ernst Cassirer. So, what he says is just the idea of Hilbert is kind of rewrite Euclid, right? So that's very interesting work, Foundation of Geometry. That that book, how to say, did not serve, and I think was not intended so far as a really foundation of geometry, because already in Hilbert's time, in the 20th century, geometry was much more complicated than that. Actually, that's at best foundation of Euclidean geometry, no more than that. So topics like Riemannian geometry which were really hard there at that time of Hilbert, not included. But that's theoretically, nevertheless, very important, because it's just a very new way to think about old things, old stuff, right? So he says that, let us consider three distinct system of things. The things composing the first system we call points, designate them big letters. System of things of second system we call straight line, designated by small letters, and other things of third system we call planes, designated by Greek letters. The points are called the elements of linear geometry, the points and straight lines, the elements of plane geometry, the points, lines, and planes, the elements of geometry of space, or the elements of space. We think of these points, straight lines, and planes as having certain mutual relations, which we indicate by means of such words as are situated, between, parallel, congruent, continuous, etc. The complete and exact description of these relations follows as a consequence of the axioms of geometry. These axioms may be arranged in five groups, and then he gives five groups. The whole point here that those words, like point, lines, they shouldn't be, according to this idea, taking in kind of direct naive sum. Basically, they have no reference here. That's why he starts to speak about things, right? And then we say, okay, we just conventionally use those traditional names. Even that, we are not obliged to think them, you know, in anything like usual way, right? And the same goes for relations, like between, parallel, and so on and so far. So the idea is that we, as axioms of this discipline of geometry, we just provide purely formal statements, right, about some things, as he calls them, things designated by letter. Actually, specifically, there are three types of things here, right? In later versions of the same approach, people usually use just one type of things, you know, points. So I would not comment on this typing here. Right. So the whole idea that we provide kind of, as Hilbert himself call it a conceptual scheme for thinking, say, about space. And then we may kind of fill in the schemes by whatever we like or whatever is more appropriate, seems to be more appropriate. Yeah. Here, actually, I put this it was one of examples that motivated, well, the main motivating example for Hilbert. That's example of projective duality. And what is projective duality? Actually, in usual Euclidean geometry, we have, maybe I write it here, we have points and have straight lines, right? And for every two points, we have a unique straight line going through them, right? And we have also, so we have just one line which corresponds, say, to two points, A and B, right? And then try to exchange line for points and points for line. This is a trick, right? So here we might have two lines. I just use the same letters, A and B, but now they are no longer points but lines, right? And again, we have a single point here, right? Line A, point here. So the idea that we may actually interpret this letter A, here is a point and here is a line. The thing is that in Euclidean geometry it doesn't work perfectly, right? Because we have this case of parallel lines. But in projective geometry, all lines intersect. And also somehow reason for doing all these formalities and going to this original thinking was that actually we cannot good imagine that. We can't imagine that coherently, even if I just mentioned this less counterintuitive that it might seem, because you know if you look at say railways which go to horizon, you see them intersecting. So it's not and that's historically projective geometry just derived for studying of perspective from that kind of thing. So that idea to break with intuition, to break to anything we can perceive and see was rather specific and rather late. Right? But that's nevertheless crucial for that approach and that approach became extremely influential, say 20th century. So most of 20th century mathematics was following this kind of approach. Of course, we may mention, say, in non-Euclidean geometry, again, the early works in non-Euclidean, like Lobachevsky works, were all drawing from intuition, actually. Yeah, because exactly this parallel postulate, which distinguishes, say, Euclidean geometry from Lobachevsky geometry, is not intuitively evident. So in a sense, it's a good evidence for saying that intuition works pretty good. That's exactly something that intuitively, not at all obvious, right? This postulate actually led to new developments in geometry. So we may think about geometry, but at some point, just people decided, look, it's just too confusing, all this intuition. We should do something that wouldn't depend of our geometrical intuition, right? And so the idea here that we produce this formal theory, right? Even in that approach is not yet formal in modern sense. Actually, in the 20s already, Hilbert with collaborators, he developed what became known as Hilbert formalism. So then the idea was not just writing these axioms in kind of natural language, just occasionally using letters, as mathematicians did at least since Euclid, and then in a different way since 17th century, but just writing all this formal, completely in formal way, in formal syntax with a formal, some form of formal calculus. So, and then the idea is to interpret, right, this theory somewhere. When one interprets this, people say one gets a model of this thing, right? And then, of course, the question is, at which extent your theory determines possible model, okay? If very different models are possible, say all So we may interpret our letters in such a way that all axioms are satisfied, right? And so we derive different things, but at the same thing, that can be done in very different, say, systems and very different environment, then we would say that the theory just not adequate in the sense that it does determine its object, right? Because we may just have very different thing. So the idea was, the say, kind of methodological ideal, was that this formal theory should determine its model in some sense unique. But in which sense unique? Of course, if we don't fix this object field, so to speak, from the very beginning, so we say allow lines be points and points be lines and things like that, so it cannot be unique in kind of straightforward sense, right? In some obvious, self-obvious sense. So the idea was to make it unique up to isomorphism, to put it in modern language. That means the following, that suppose we have two different models, right? Two different system of things, as Hilbert puts that, that all verifies all axioms and hence all theorems of our theory, right? And then it may be the case that if we have two models, it's always possible to put the elements in one-one correspondence, right? So basically, two models would be different only in respect of different fillers, so to speak, to these letters, all right, and relations as well, right? Because when I interpret my theory, I interpret not only say individuals but also relations between them. That's crucial. And axioms, they are not about contentful relations, right? But about formal properties of relations. For example, if I say if I take relation of being parallel, right, as a, for example, for fifth postulate, I say that it is equivalence relation, right? So it's reflexive, it's transitive, it's symmetric. So I just take those formal properties of relations as my axioms. That's what Hilbert actually did. Okay? And actually, the beginning, when Hilbert just published, made the first edition of his book on Foundation of Geometry, he somehow believed that it may work more or less automatically, that if you make good theories. But then was rather soon discovered, so I say it was, in a sense, bad news, that it's actually not the case. So if you put a theory in a very general situation, you have something what today people call intendant model. So you still have something like, say, traditional Euclidean geometry in mind. But then it still becomes possible not only makes things like this, because here we really have this isomorphism. That's easy, right? But we may have so-called non-standard model. So that property for theory, that all its models are isomorph, which was later called by Veblen, also Veblen categoricity, that term, I say, has nothing to do with category theory. That's very strong property, and it holds for some, actually, usually very weak theories, but generally it doesn't hold. Then actually Hilbert tried to use, say, more stronger logical means to force this property, right? Something like second-order logic. But that's also rather controversial move for different reasons, which I not try to explain. Those things that I mentioned now, it's a big topic, say, in analytic philosophy and model theory and kind of philosophy which is around model theory. At least philosophers very much draw this notion of intendant model. And personally, I think that it still shows that in a sense, project that doesn't work. And personally, I don't think that something like intended model is really it's rather controversial, because the whole idea behind this approach, right, it just really make things formal and precise, just avoid all kind of, you know, this intuitive confusion. And then after all that, we just come to this notion that intended model, which is intuitive, but not in some precise sense intuitive, but really in very, very vague sense. So that's more or less how this kind of theory works, okay? Then, it's not on my side, I probably should mention that important motivation behind this kind of approach was, in a sense, to break the dependence of mathematics of objecthood, right? For Kant, for example, this objecthood was really a principal point about mathematics. Among other things, for Kant, it was the main mark distinguishing, say, philosophical speculative thinking from mathematical thinking. He just said, okay, give a philosopher a triangle and ask him to deduce the fact that the sum of internal angles is two right angles. And say, philosophy is absolutely hopeless because, okay, he takes definition of triangle, definition of angle, definition of what is number three and so on, and you are lost, you have nothing. And geometry just makes this construction, put a triangle at this first place, right? So we have here in something like individual, not just general concept, but individual object, right? Then, and that's of course, in a sense, a matter of guess, we need some additional construction, and finally we kind of prove the theorem, right? So this, here is two right angles, and then of course we need to fill in all details, but all that only works when we have this individual construction. But then, for reasons that I actually already mentioned, right, that arguably mathematics went beyond those kind of intuitions, right, it arguably became just kind of purely conceptual, purely abstract. And so one of ideas behind Hilbert thinking was to get rid of that, right? Just make from mathematics kind of systematic, pure speculation. Actually, in his later project, when I mentioned what we call formal mathematics in more precise sense, there his position is more delicate. Perhaps I'll mention that, because I think it's really important when we think about what formalization is about. Because that he actually tried to keep Kant in line, but in a very specific way. He thought, okay, we have this way of writing, right? Something like in elementary algebra, right? A plus B and so on. And here we deal actually with intuitively very clear objects. Right, something like we can also link it to, say, just alphabetic writing. At least we have here combinatorics of symbols, and that's, mathematically speaking, in good intuitive objects, say, in Kantian sense. And then he thought, okay, we should just stick to that, right? We might have some ideas about spaces, whatever, vague intuition, but those intuitions just are too vague to be reliable in mathematics. So the only reliable intuition in mathematics, according to late Hilbert, is symbolic intuition, is intuition about symbols, right? And so the project is somehow to reduce all mathematical, say, thinking, or at least all presentation of ready-made results. That's also important, because Hilbert always made reservations that say, of course, heuristically, it's very important to have some complicated intuition, but as far as we consider the theory as ready-made, as, you know, presentable, we should just
cut all this stuff off and present it as a symbolic construction. Because here in symbols we have very clear intuitions. We may distinguish A plus B and so on and so forth. And so that was more or less the project. Yeah. And then, of course, it went through logic in a certain sense, right? Because this basic rules about, say, symbols, they're basically logical rules about how to do logical calculus, which serves in this setting as a foundation actually for doing or at least presenting mathematical results. Okay. So in a sense, the idea was to get rid of objects except formal expressions, right? So that's what is behind what people some say, okay, Hilbert tried to reduce everything to finite strings of symbols, and all mathematics is kind of senseless game of symbols, senseless combinatoric of symbols. It's not senseless, of course, in Hilbert's understanding, but it's the most reliable, okay? But actually, the later development of mathematics in 20th century, I think, in a sense, restored, it found a specific way of building mathematical objects, right? So in a sense, it didn't follow this extreme Hilbert formalisms. And actually, that was made with the notion of set. We've seen in this... quote earlier, he talks about system of things, right? System, but what is system of things, right? He speaks very informally. But if we do something more precise about that, and that what indeed happened in history, that system of things became sets. Importantly, we need infinite collections, right here. Those systems must be infinite. We cannot just do geometry with... we cannot do all geometry, put it this way, with just finite number of points, finite number of line. And as far as mathematicians got this notion of through development of set theory, through Cantor and later developments, so they became very happy about them, including Hilbert himself. His famous phrase that nobody would push us out from Cantor's paradise. He calls Cantor's paradise. So basically, those system of things became sets, and in even Cantor's understanding, they would be sets of something, right? Like sets of numbers, sets of points. But already in axiomatics developments, when people try to minimize what we do really need for thinking about sets, that notion of that sometimes usually referred to by German word Ur element was actually found redundant. So, say, in what is today standard axiomatization of set theory, there is no Ur element. That means that every set is a set of sets. There is no other things but sets. And there is basic relations, which is a relation of membership. One set is a member of another set. And except, say, empty set, which has no elements. But at least there is no other sorts of entities, right? And in that setting, actually, people... You see, in Hilbert, he thinks, without this thinking, that everything can be replaced by something, right? By line, by points, by number, for example, as he provides different models. But now... Now I refer more or less to works by group mathematicians, who French mathematicians, who wrote under the common name, invented name of Nicolas Bourbaki, and who once again tried to rewrite Euclid, in a sense following this major line of structural mathematics of 20th century as defined by Gilbert, but I think with important... say modification that for them sets are no longer just you know, abstract things that, that should be or can be every time replaced by something, right? But they really became kind of material from which mathematical objects are constructed, right? So that's rather different notion of set, in my understanding. Mm. And so here I just give an example. Maybe some of you know how mathematical objects are constructed. The whole idea is, in a sense, is very close to Hilbert. Just take a set and put a structure on it. So what does it mean to put a structure? I just give an example. Maybe it's better than try to describe in general words. So what is a group? The notion group in the sense of group theory, right? That notion actually, which dates back to this early 19th century, and first it was put forward by Veris Galois, so that was about permutations, in his case of permutations of roots of polynomials, but it may be just permutations of anything, right? If we permute things and we permute them again, we have again a permutation, which is composition of those two permutations, okay? By the way, you can check it's not commutative, so if you make one permutation first, and second, it just depends of order, in which order you're doing permutation. Anyway, there are simple axioms that every permutation is reversible. If you permute things, you can always permute them back. And also you may introduce kind of identity permutation, which doesn't mean that you don't permute anything. And that was, you know, all the notion of group. Then it was very much elaborated by Felix Klein, who found it in geometry, applied it to geometry. So you may think, for example, about a cube or any regular polygon or polyhedra. And then basically group or to every regular, what does it mean that a polyhedron is regular? It means that there are symmetries there, right? In formulae. But what does it mean symmetries? Symmetries then that you may turn it in a way that it coincides again with itself, right? And all these turns, there are many of them, right? And they are composable. You turn one once, you can twice, and what you obtain is a composition of two turns is again turn. And every turn is reversible. Okay, that's that. But here it's presentation of the same idea in this structural setting. And here we say the following. Okay, we have just a set, kind of underlying set, G. Then we have this group operation. Set, actually, you should think of set of, if you apply that for case of polyhedron, that would be set of turns, okay? If you apply permutation, that would be set of permutations. Another example, if we just take, for example, whole numbers, right? They form a group by addition, but you should add negative, right? Otherwise, you don't always have reverse operation. So here we have some absolute set. We have a group operation. Operation means that if we take two elements of sets, there is a third element which associated in a unique way, in the determined way. So two, the order matters here, right? Because it's generally not commutative. And then we say that there is this identity. Identity of the group, just think of, as I say, of identity permutation, don't permute anything, which let me say multiply, right? I may use any word for this operation. To add or multiply, let me say multiply. So we this property of unit of group, so if you multiply this unit from the right of, or I put the same thing, should be the other way around. From the left, we have the same element here, right? Then for every element of a group, there is inverse element. And inverse element means that, again, in both ways, we get back one, right? Like two permutations. Permute this way, I returned to to nothing permuted, so I return to one, and permutation is associative. Okay, I'll not comment, that's very important, associativity, but maybe I'll not comment on that. Right, so that's abstract notion of group. And Bourbaki actually managed to put nearly all mathematics in that kind of language. And of course, if they only would put all the mathematical language, that wouldn't be, how to say, interesting, at least for mathematicians, not for mathematicians. But a lot of new mathematics, of course, were developed in that way. All right? Now, another important notion which somehow came with was a notion of maps between structures, right? One maybe basic map I already mentioned. I mentioned isomorphism, right, when I talked about models. But actually, when we talk about isomorphism, there is ambiguity, because people, we may mean, say, different things by isomorphism, right? We may just mean a relation, and people always do that. It's always useful. So I say two structures are isomorph. So they're isomorph, they are not isomorph, right? What does it mean they're isomorph? There is one-to-one correspondence between the elements, which, as people like to put it, preserve structure. What does it mean preserve structure? First, for sets, it's just one-to-one correspondence, okay? But then, still, it's not a bare set. It's all this kind of jargon of this mathematics. It's not a bare set, but set with structure, that can with group operation on it, right? So it's too, how say, too weak a property that just underlying sets, for example, of two groups are isomorph, right? But we want to be groups to be isomorph. That, informally speaking, that means that operations here and here, say, here are two groups, right? And here our operation is star, and here our operation just circle, a little circle. They correspond to each other. What does it mean? That if I apply this transformation, so I just look where by my correspondence goes element G1, where goes G2, and where goes their product, right? And what I want to preserve the structure is that G1 here, G1 goes, here is G2 goes somewhere, right, by the action of this, say, function. And then I want that the product in that sense in one group goes to product in the second group. But one should be careful that group operations are generally different here. Here it's, so it's not product in the same sense in one group and in the other group, right? So that what does mean to be isomorph in case of structured set, the set with the structure, right? Just coming back, what isomorph? So isomorphism is a relation. When I say two structures are isomorph, right? That means that there exists an isomorphism. Right? And what is isomorphism in that second sense? What exists? Isomorphism. It's not a relation, of course. It's a concrete map. Right, so we should distinguish the thing. They're often confused. Isomorphism is a relation, to be isomorph, not to be isomorph. And isomorphism is a specific map. And of course, if you have, even if you take sets, for example, I have sets of two elements here, right? And sets of two elements here, right? And how many isomorphisms there exist? At least two, right? So I can put this way, and I can put this way. But there are two different maps. And if I call this is A, this is B, right? A, B, then I say, okay, there is this one isomorphism and the other, and they are not the same. Okay, so we may distinguish isomorphism as maps, okay? And moreover, here I just say isomorphism, I put arrows in both sides, right? But usually people, when talk about map, we just count one map in one side. it's again, we may say linguistic convention, but that's actually important. Because so far for isomorphism, and why isomorphism is important of all these approaches, I mentioned that the whole idea of the structural mathematics is, so to speak, to do mathematics up to isomorphism. So if we have groups, we would actually would count isomorphic group as the same group, right? When people say about, say, symmetric group of three elements and all this groups, I don't know, quantum mechanics, wherever, actually all groups have individual names, but this individual name applies to, say, class of isomorphic groups. It does make sense to distinguish between isomorphic groups, right? That's so far for isomorphism. But there naturally arises a more general notion of map, which of course also already starting with functions. If we have just sets, we have, say, the case when there is one-one correspondence, but we have a more general case that there is correspondence, say, that works just one way. And here we may have some more elements, for example, right? Or we may have here in another elements, and that goes to the same element here. What we cannot have that just one element goes to two other elements. Yeah? That wouldn't be called a function, because we want that every element has a precise image. So if we say what is value of this function f from this element here, that is supposed to be determined. Otherwise, it's called relation in general sense, and not a function, right? So we have this notion of function, which is generally, say, non-reversible, in the sense that it just goes one way, not the other way. And we have corresponding notion of a structure preserving. It's not called function in that context. It's called, in context of group theory, it's called homomorphism. Actually, would be reasonable to use this way, this name everywhere. It was just historically that those things were first described for groups. So this name normally used only for groups, and a more general notion people just call morphism, or map, structure-preserving map, okay? And basically, condition for this, it doesn't change. We can use the same condition for describing structure-preserving maps, which are not reversible. We don't need another condition. That means, for example, those things, images of G1 or G2 may coincide here, right? It just would mean that we put, like shown here, we have two elements of group here, and they go to the same element, right? And people, I think what is also kind of, how say, perhaps difficulties of this, or kind of bad impact of this structural thinking, that people think about homomorphism by analogy with isomorphism. And I think it's quite wrong. Even in language, it's usual to call those maps structure preserving. But if you consider a case group, you see that it's not even quite appropriate name. For example, any group, whatever, can be mapped to any other group by a map that just sends every element of first group to unit of this other group, right? And this condition is trivially satisfied then. But then, of course, we wouldn't say, in a sense, we just collapse our group to unit, and there is no much sense saying we preserve structure. But still, that's not arbitrarily map, right? It's also a specific feature of this thinking that all structure-preserving map are seen as set theoretic functions at first place, and then with some additional condition. So every map here is a function, right, with some condition. That's because we put this set theoretic background to begin with. Right. And we'll see that in category theory that's going to be changed. Okay, I'm not doing very well this time. That's so far about mathematics of 20th century, structural mathematics of 20th century. Maybe Maybe we do, yeah, we want a little bit of questions and then I continue to categorize it.
I mean, if I understand it right, it would mean one of the basic steps would be to say that the step of abstraction from the things which would be physically there to the formal notion of things would change the level of where properties are ascribed into a projective scale in a way. Like when you say an isomorphism means between all the elements of a set, then we could say all the black items on the table would be in one group, but then to relate, because we traditionally were doing that always, the properties that we ascribe to these elements, to the elements that we actually refer to, would be a big problem, no? And that these kinds of levels of formality or abstraction have the different names of homo isomorphism, homomorphism, or the generally morphisms. Don't you think they are important to distinguish to make these levels?
First of all, about property, actually, that was traditional problem, that this notion of property, which is, say, basic for Aristotelian logic, is actually not that much, doesn't play that role in mathematics that, say, plays in usual natural language. Because, for example, see, even in Hilbert's example, it's not included, but he speaks about relations. Right, that's more important. Say, for example, saying that three points lies belong to the same line, right? And that's three place relations. Mm-hmm. Riemann's triplet. Just saying mathematics, point is without parts, or circle is round. Is actually not less important. So in a sense, that was important step already, right? That I have no time to speak about parallel developments in logic, but exactly what happened with Frege and Russell, that they, in a sense, they put properties on equal footing with relations.
Mm.
Yeah,
exactly.
For them, it's just one place relations.
Exactly.
Right? So, and so the idea is to, right, one important idea, in a sense, to get rid of intuitive objects in usual sense, just to replace them by these formal objects.
Mm-hmm.
And formal objects, by the way, are intuitive and almost material, right? Like symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. But then allow ourselves to interpret those symbols in different ways.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. But what happened, say, between Hilbert and Bourbaki, what I would like to say, that for Hilbert, those things would be what, you know, some philosophers call like placeholders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're just places to be filled by some intuition, or that's just another topic I'm not going to speak, by some other mathematical things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, we may represent a point by a pair of real numbers, meaning something like coordinate system,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we would obtain a arithmetical model of geometry.
Mm-hmm.
For Hilbert project, that was very important, but I won't speak about that, right? But then, say, in this Bourbaki setting, they already used those, things, which are called already sets,
mm-hmm.
they are used as kind of material for building objects. And I also think that people develop certain intuitions about sets, how to think about them.
Mm. By getting used and working.
Yeah, but then again, the idea that all interesting, say, relevant properties are so-called structural properties.
Mm-hmm.
And structure is something which is invariant, which is defined up to isomorphism, invariant to isomorphism. So you may feel these things in different ways, right? But there are some properties which does depend on that, how you feel those things,
mm-hmm.
right? But importantly, that works only when there is theory is categorical,
mm-hmm.
right? And generally, since the theory is not categorical, so we may really ask whether this kind of thinking is really, I'll say, appropriate to begin with.
But mm-hmm. Then in a historical perspective, it was the change about where do we derive our notion of properties from? No? From the things that are described, or do we construct the forms of looking at things which we can only then describe in things, like a reversal
I should maybe better understand what you mean property. Mathematicians actually is kind of logicians concerned about properties. In mathematics, the important part is put some principle and prove theorems or solve problems. That's a bit different thing, right? So, and then usually talk about properties is kind of informal in mathematics. So,
yeah.
Technically, the notion of property, I'm not sure that plays a role.
Yeah. In the application of mathematics, it starts to play a role. That's where I'm asking from. But it's a...
If we prove something, I don't know, like Fermat theorem or something, it's about properties or not. But here, there was some thinking that, more general thinking about behind this picture, that mathematics is about patterns. You know what of thinking, and then we may kind of, in a sense, it's very traditional Platonic idea, right? Where we have this science of patterns, which we may apply elsewhere, right? Perhaps a new thing that we for 20th century we can kind of apply it inside mathematics itself.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to.
Yeah, so now I maybe just make it very shortly this remark, because it's a big topic, but already embodiment. So in classical case, okay, I already mentioned this notion that we kind of supposed to instantiate general concept like triangle by concrete object. Right, that was going on in classical mathematics, what, say, Kant accounts for in many details. And actually with set theory, there came about, I would call it, a new way of producing mathematical objects. Say, with triangles, this works actually, but think about number, the general concept of number, right? How we may instantiate it. Okay, I may instantiate it by, referring to number 3, for example, right? But in a sense, number 3, it's also, we may distinguish, it may be understood as a concept. But if I write it or put 3 bars or something like that, I can say, okay, I got kind of picture of this number, either symbolic or even kind of hieroglyphic, I don't know, more direct picture if I put 3 bars. But I cannot, but still it how to say, I cannot directly form an object in this classical setting from general notion of number, right? I make something specific like number 3 or 5 or 4, whatever the choice, but I cannot just objectify or embody this concept of number. With set theory, we can, for example, talk about set of natural numbers. If we put all the, of course, set of natural numbers is not a number, like you said, of chairs is not a chair, right? But it's kind of object, and I insist that it's an object formed on the basis of concept of number, and that's object which we may operate, right? It's not just that we can imagine it somehow. We can square it. Here I make 2 in power of n, and I take actually real numbers that way. We can add them. So we may operate with the thing like we operate with individual numbers, all right? And that's kind of extension way. So we just imagine that. Think that way, that all numbers form particular collection, and we somehow take all of them and do something with all of them. Okay, that's what's going on with category with set theory. But there is also certain limit. For example, think about concept of set itself, right? Couldn't we the same way you think about set of all sets? Again, we would take something. Why if set of all numbers, why not set of all sets? But that was found to be problematic. Here I pose this famous Russell paradox. Yeah, that, okay, maybe I'll not explain. Later in question someone won. But that appears to be problematic, this kind of thing, right? we try to form a set of all sets which are not elements. Set of all sets is element of itself, right? Because it is a set. And if we try now set of so-called normal sets which are not elements of themselves, then we get a problem, because if it is element of itself, then it's not, and that way around. So here is the problem. And one solution was suggested by von Neumann, actually, to he introduced this notion of class, more general notion of sets. And classes which are not sets are called proper classes. And usually it is thought to be something larger than sets, something huge. And the rule that is that, say, a set may be an element of class, but class cannot be an element of another class. It's kind of forbidden artificially. So there is a way to get around that problem, but still that notion of proper class sometimes it's used, you know, for teaching this kind of thing, but it's not particularly interesting. I mean, there is no interesting construction with proper classes, unlike construction with sets, right? And why I'm mentioning that, because it's one way, it's not historically the reason why categories were introduced, but I think it's kind of suggestive way to think about categories. Because now here is the idea. As I mentioned, this notion of structure, now I mean particular structure like a group, for example, right? So we may think about a group as a set, the structure up to isomorphism, so it's in a sense well-formed mathematical object, right? The notion of group itself cannot be thought. So if we might think about all groups, it's like about all sets, right? So we may talk about proper class of all groups, but it's not, say, it's too poor to do anything with that. On the other hand, as I mentioned, every notion of structure, this Bourbaki structure, comes with some notion of transformation of this structure preserving map. Although sometimes it needs some additional, determination, because it's not always this notion of appropriate notion of map. It does not follow immediately from definition of your structure, actually. For example, for topological spaces, what we require, it's not that we might expect, just following example of groups, that we would need in topological space that every open space is mapped to open space, open subspace, subset. But that's not, appears to be not a good, you know, notion of continuity, and that's called continuous transformation, right? But the notion is different. We need that every inverse image, the prototype of every open space, open set is open. And that was found more or less, by experience. But anyway, if we take this point of view, which a little bit different from this classical structure, right? We say not only structures are important, but also transformation between structures are important, right? Transformation is just another word for map, which comes from geometry, right? So we have type of structure. Actually, when I talk about, gave definition of group, it doesn't determine the structure, right? Because groups are not all isomorph, obviously. Already because not all sets are isomorph, right? And for other reasons too. So there are a lot of different groups, right? So groups represent a type of structure. And we would like to build kind of object on this general notion of group. Not this or that particular group, but really general. And that's what notion of category allows for. So basically for group, category of group is what? Is we take all groups, whatever this might mean, and all homomorphism of group, right? And that, of course, when I say all groups, it should be something like proper class. And that, as I mentioned, appeared to be too poor to do anything with that. But if we think about groups and their maps, then it becomes an interesting mathematical object, which is called category of groups. And other examples would be, say, for sets, would we mean what? We say we take all sets, all functions between all sets. Okay. And the idea, of course, that we may describe some properties of maps, which are not exactly structural properties, exactly. They are not preserved under isomorphism. So they don't belong to any particular set, any particular group. They belong to this type of structure, right? But now we formed another object. You know, if you think about that, it seems to be kind of huge object, and that's some people find it difficult. But actually, no, at least it's not more, no more difficult than with sets. And studying properties of maps, right? We may say a lot about how it works, about that object. That's basic idea, right? And now I just give formal definition. So, what category consists of class of objects? Just thinks of groups or sets of topological spaces or vector spaces with linear transformation, whatever. Then, for any pair of objects, there is a class of maps from one object to another. The sense matters here, of course, right? Which are called morphisms. Then, for every map, we determine its source and target, right? So that's prescribed, called domain and codomain here. Okay, second thing. Then we have this operation. That's important. I didn't mention that when I spoke about maps, but that's kind of intuitively very clear that maps are composable, right? You map one thing to other thing, and then this and the third thing, and you you map A to B, B to C, and you obtain another map here. So we have something like algebraic operation, right? Which there is actually two different ways to write it. I use this geometrical order, okay? So FG in the same order as here. More popular actually is a reverse algebraic order, which just comes, if I put X, right? And then F from X, and then J from X, you know, it just goes to the left. Right, so if I want to write composition of these two functions, people write usually algebraic convention is this. Even that means that F is applied first and G is applied after. Right? You see, it's the opposite of it. And here I use rather geometrical order. Right, so we have this operation, which is also associative, and actually now with this associativity I can draw as a picture, as a diagram. It will be something like a parallelogram, or it could be a square, of course. Right, so I have F, G, H. Here I have this composition, and associativity means that composition doesn't depend of order in that way, so I can compose this thing, this two first, and then add second, or I may compose this first and add that, right? But of course, here in a category, unlike, say, situation with a group or anything like that, with the usual algebra, if we have, say, Fj, then the opposite thing, Jf, generally just not defined. Right, so our composition is only defined when the target of first map just coincide with source of the second. That's only with that condition that maps are composable. So it's not, algebraically speaking, the operation is partial. It's not defined for every pair of maps. Okay. And finally, we introduce, it's more like in group theory, we introduce identity maps from every object, right, which also neutral with respect to this operation. But when we say it's neutral, again, we should be careful about which composition exists, which don't exist, right? And basically, it's kind of a remark that as far as we introduce these identity maps, objects actually become redundant, right? Just we may just identify every object with identity map, right? But still, people, if we are thinking about categories in that way, as I described, more or less like categories of groups, sets, topological space, then we kind of have this topological spaces first, and then we connect them by morphism, and that makes a category. But more categorical way of thinking would be, of course, somehow just to reduce the whole thing to just morphism. You don't really need objects, they don't add anything to the settings. Okay. And that's the kind of, as I told you, it always could be with some reservation prove a theorem that all types of structures form a category with, you know, the proviso that we really specify what kind of maps are. And actually that was historically a very important understanding, that it's not sufficient, mathematically speaking, to determine what your structure is, right? If you just I give definition of groups, okay, with groups it works. But in more complicated case, it was remarked that we should also specify maps. Unless we specified maps, we somehow didn't specify what we are really talking about. And that...
May I ask?
Sure.
So all these category stuff is could be summarized as just an abstract group on morphisms. Somehow, in colloquial style.
Yeah, but be careful about term group, right? Because it refers to group in
yes.
different sense.
Yeah. But in a way, you have the same kind of thinking you are applying on morphisms instead of...
No, basically, yeah. Formally speaking, you have
set.
Class or whatever collection of morphisms, some of which are identity morphisms, which are distinguished, of course, right, among other. And there is partial operation of composition on those things. And there are many identity, what is rather unusual from pure algebraic point of view, because normally in an algebraic structure you have one unit, right? You can also have, like in a field, you can unit and zero, stuff like that, right? But here you have many units. It's nice structure. I don't think it's really structure, but it's nice mathematical construction, because it's very nicely combines say, geometrical and algebraic properties. So you have actually many units. Units are your objects, basically, right? And you have this partial operation. If you know, there was this notion of groupoid, which was invented actually before category theory. And groupoid was meant, you know, like a group, but this operation defined only partially. And here you see that actually, categorically speaking, groupoid is just a category such that any morphism is isomorphism. I'll explain a little bit more. Okay, that's a bit, I don't know, reconstruction of history in a sense. Is how categories came about. Without, I cannot explain our really important reason why they were useful and kind of justified. That would lead us too far to pure mathematics. But as far as... So you see, they are introduced kind of naturally in this structural setting, right? The notion of categories. For some obscure... still obscure for me, historical reasons, Bourbaki themselves never used that, because they already knew that writing of Bourbaki and development category theory was more or less parallel. So we cannot, it would be historically untrue that categories came later. But they somehow decided, actually, that was mostly Dieudonné who decided not to go to category theory. So they have, in the first volume on set theory, they have fourth chapter, which is about structures in general, so kind of general theory of structure, and actually you see that most of theorem very transformed it, translated into category theory, and certainly people knew that. It's absolutely impossible that they wouldn't, because some of, actually, MacLean was collaborating, Eilenberg was one of also invented of category theory, was actually made, was an invited member of Bourbaki, so they knew everything well, but somehow they decided not to go for that. And maybe...
Have you a hypothesis why?
I have, there is, I even spoke, for example, for some people like Pierre Cartier, who was a member and still active. There is a lot of kind of small explanations, I mean, for some personal historical reasons. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to push the idea that they actually, if they would decide to go to category theory, they would need to rethink very radically, very profoundly the whole project. That's what maybe not how they would think themselves, but I...
Would it be compatible with this assumption to look at sets in a quasi-material way that was important for them? Would there be a problem?
I don't know. No, actually, they many of those people, and later, certainly, they would be people who would promote category theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would see in category theory kind of later development, kind of structuralist dream,
mm-hmm.
you know? So we are doing now pure structures without any material. We get rid of materials. But I don't think that was certainly an kind of intention which didn't, as a matter of fact, it was not, you know, worked out, mm-hmm. right? And I think that it was not worked out for serious reason. I don't think that it can be easily. No, you know, there are a lot of ways to put category theory, and perhaps nothing can be said really in definite way, but I think that at least category theory has a potential to very different thinking about mathematics, and perhaps kind of underlying reason that people kind of felt that if it's kind of would kill the project, you know, if they go category theory, so we would better just leave it for later thing. But that's, say, my hypothesis. But now I would like, okay, as far as we introduce that in that categorical setting. But now we can do something, say, forgetting about that setting, right? No, maybe we start with not just forgetting, but just trying to mimicking it, right? So here we have, for example, I showed this very simple notions of injective map, which means that every image, every image has just unique pre-image, right? Inverse image. It's unique, so there is no case where two different elements just are sent to one element like that. That's called injective, right? And that's one important special case of map in general. And another important special case when our target structure, there is no empty space left, like here, right? It's called surjective, which just covers it, right? And apparently, this kind of things, we really need all the elements to define those notions. But actually, we can define them purely, so without talking about elements. And it's not... It's actually a kind of generalization, of course, but we may have a case when our map is cancelable from the right? Like here. And it's very immediate to check that if the map is injective, it is the case, and actually it is even a little bit more general the case, right? So we found a way to express this property, which set theoretically always gives us injective, okay? And surjective would be just dual from the other side. But interesting thing, for example, is that in sense which if a map is both injective and surjective, then what? That's easy. Let's imagine, here is injective, here is surjective, and if it's both, what happens.
Territorial
morph? Yeah. But in categories, it is not the case. So first we need... So we need first define what does mean isomorphic, because we cannot rely any longer on this idea of one-to-one correspondence. And we actually need two conditions, which also very important to distinguish. I think it's also very, suggestive even in many ways, because when people say, okay, there is some transformation, there is reverse. But what does it mean that it's reverse? And actually there are two conditions, each of which is necessary but not sufficient. So we want, if we combine this way, F first, then J, we want identity here, right? Which is automatic as far as there is at most one map in one direction. But if there are many maps, right, in case of any this set theoretic structure, right, then of course it's not the case generally. So we want identity this way, and also we want identity the other way around. Right? So there are these two conditions, then we call this map isomorphism, but in a category, those two properties, they don't imply that. And there are examples when we can show that. So in a sense, of course, this say epimorphism, that's true that every set theoretic subjection is epimorphism, but that does mean that this categorical epimorphism is exactly the same. So in a sense, we generalize, we're changing a little bit idea, but say connect to our old ideas. And that is a very important mathematics, right? Because it's important to invent new stuff and solve problems, which are the most important. But also important somehow to retell everything that we already know. So if we just invent something which has no connection to the past, doesn't work. Okay. Or it wouldn't be mathematics anyway. Yeah, so that's you see examples which properties kind of mimic, which retell us what we do in set theoretic mathematics. Two further examples of the same kind. Actually, we can redefine notion of group. Or if you want, it's not a big deal, of course, you know, for a mathematician, it's kind of trivial. Mathematician will say, okay, show me when it solves the problems that I cannot solve before. And actually, it took about 20 years for category theory to work in that way. And now it's solved problems that were not solved, say in knot theory, recent results. So now it works. But for philosopher, maybe that's more interesting myself, just put things in different way. And so we can, instead of saying that group is, as I told you, is a set with operation, I may just say it's a category with a single object, right? That way we have single unit there. And such that every morphism is isomorphism, every morphism is reversible, right? You see, and then, okay, all our axioms for category just trivially implies this axioms for group, of course, right? So we represent group in that way, and that's in which sense that's interesting, because here there is no this object, this single object is not a structure really, right? It's say one shouldn't think about that as a group, as a set, because it's not group of isomorphism. Maybe in the second example this is even clearer what I want to say, because another important kind of structure which I didn't talk is structure of pre-order and all specification like partial order and so on so far. Now, pre-order basically in Bourbaki setting is defined as whatever relation which is reflexive and which is transitive. Okay? X is... and which is transitive. And here we can just say, okay, pre-order is a category such that there is at most one morphism in one direction. So it's very simple. Here we have one object and many morphisms. It will give out a group. And here we have many objects and very little morphisms. If we also say here, if I have it both ways, it's naturally an isomorphism, of course, right? Because there is no other morphism. And so if I also identify those objects, say, up to isomorphism, so I get what's called partial order, which is also this property called anti-symmetry. If A... if A is not less than B, and B than A, then A is the same as B. Yeah, so that's an example of a category where objects are not structures, and the morphisms are not structure-preserving maps, right? So it's kind of pure category theory. Even it's not a big deal. Right. Look, now I was going actually to introduce some first steps in really category theory, but I don't know, maybe I have no time.
No.
Because that's rather mathematical. Maybe I better speak, because otherwise I want to speak about topuses.
So we have to choose. Yeah.
Or we can make longer.
Axiomatically or or practically.
Yeah. I don't know.
But if you can have a 5-minute break,
fine. Yeah, let's have a 5-minute break. I'll see. Okay, then I'll try to present it, but briefly.